Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeffrey Tankus. And with that, I'll pass it to the moderator for the call, David Lundgren.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to the call. John, we're going to start with some relatively good news first. We have a lot of issues this month to deal with, but I guess from a positive perspective, second quarter GDP was released and it came in at a stronger than expected 4%. And there were several other indicators that were steady and in some cases even improving. So from the economic growth standpoint, at least here in the United States, things seem to be okay. Give us your thoughts on that.
There was some concern based on the negative quarter. Well, the initial negative report for the last quarter was the first quarter was a minus 2.9%, which far exceeded any estimates that was later changed to about a minus 2%. But still somewhat below expectations given what was going on at the time, and it was some concern then that, perhaps we might be, sinking toward a recession or perhaps a significant trend change was in prospect. But we probably talked about this in one of our earlier conversations that, the coincident indicators that we look at to keep track of what might be happening, before we see the GDP numbers were generally pretty positive in suggesting that we were probably still in some sort of positive trend, although, of course, we don't try to really project what's going to happen from, from one quarter to the next. But anyway, it looked like, that minus quarter in the first part of the year, while it was not all weather-related, probably did not necessarily suggest that the trend was going to change. So we got an initial estimate of plus 4% for the second quarter, about 1.7 or 1.8% of that was inventory adjustment, which is pretty volatile. But when you take that out, because it is a fairly volatile number, you still get 2.5 to 3% real final sales number. I forget exactly what it was, but it was a pretty decent number, suggesting that the bottom line growth rate on the economy is still probably in that 2.5% range. By the way, there is a theoretical number attached to something called potential GDP that economists look at, and it's a theoretical in the sense that it is an estimate of what the economy should be capable of producing given various measures of demographics and all sorts of things. And right now that number is about 2.5%, and it varies from 2 to 2.5, depending on whether the Congressional Budget Office does it, or the Feds, or the Federal Reserve, or some of the independent economists. So, potential GDP 2, 2.5. That seems to be the trend we're on. The trend since 2009, since the recession ended, has been 2%. The average growth rate since the turn of the century. Kind of odd to say that, but since 2000 has been about 1.6-1.7%. So we do appear to be in a more moderate growth potential world, but at the same time, it doesn't appear that we are particularly close to recession, at least not in the next 3 or 4 months. Anyway, these things are never far ahead seeing indicators, but at least we seem to be okay now. Something that everybody's looking at now, and there's been a lot of talk about it recently in terms of whether the Fed is going to raise rates sooner than later and whether or not the economy is going to accelerate significantly, is the idea that wage gains may become stronger in the second half of the year. So far you don't see any of that. The recent economic reports indicate that hours worked and wages really weren't increasing. And there still appears to be too much part-time work out there and not enough full-time work. So, you know, whether or not wages are really going to increase significantly as the year progresses in a general sense. It's still kind of up in the air. The Federal Reserve recently, out in San Francisco, recently published a study looking at recent college graduates, and they concluded that if you look at the pay granted to recent college graduates for their first job, it has a fairly, you know, good correlation with what's happening to wages in general. And, you know, those numbers haven't been good for a couple of years. And so I guess the San Francisco Fed at least is going to be looking at wages for new college grads as soon as they can get some of the data to find out if they're making more money than they did last year, which, you know, might have some, you know, indication of what's happening economically. But in any case, you know, here in the U.S., it looks like we're, you know, we're still doing okay. If you go overseas, it's a different problem. You know, Europe estimates for GDP growth this year fluctuate somewhere between 0 and 1%. I think the last number I saw was about 0.5. Unemployment is still high, not really getting significantly better. And, you know, their problem, of course, is, you know, their banks are not lending. Year-over-year lending in the Eurozone is like a minus 2 or 3%. It's been that way for quite some time as the banks try to rebuild their capital, and they're much more cautious about lending, and there's not as much demand for loans in Europe either. And they got too much debt, and you know the whole story about Europe and the welfare system and, you know, debt overload and so forth and so on. So yeah, they're having a hard time really making any progress. China is slowing. No one really knows whether, you know, China is about to have a real credit issue and a real estate issue, because that's where the, you know, the imbalances seem to be. But they are on the cusp of changing from a export, you know, investment-driven economy to one that's more balanced toward consumption. And the general feeling is that as they go through this, it's not going to be, you know, particularly smooth. So the question is, you know, does China slow gradually as they change their economic makeup, or, you know, is it more, you know, more abrupt than that? So there are all these issues, you know, around the world that are not, you know, really particularly positive. They're not necessarily negative at this point, but when you think about the prospects for U.S. growth to exceed potential, you know, in a world that is, you know, demographically challenged and debt challenged and where growth is relatively slow, it's probably not likely to occur because, you know, as everybody knows, globalization has been a big thing in recent years. You know, we sell stuff to them and they sell stuff to us. And if they're not doing as well as we are, then they're not buying our stuff and so forth and so on. So, again, we seem to be sort of an island of relative prosperity in a sea of stagnation, I guess, you might say at this point, with, you know, some countries around the world doing a little better than that. But, you know, that's sort of the story. You know, it's not exciting, but it's not very bad either.
Okay, thanks. You know, one of the risks that we always talk about when we're talking about markets and economic growth is geopolitical risk. And the month of July definitely we saw our share of conflicts or issues arise, and let's take a look at a few of them. And I guess the most newsworthy was in mid-July, I think it was July 17th, a Malaysia airliner was shot down over the eastern Ukraine. Almost 300 people were killed. Pro-Russian rebels are believed to have fired the missile. You've seen a lot of sanctions get put in place now. Bring us up to date on that particular conflict and what the potential market and economic impact, you know, how much of an impact will the sanctions have on global GDP?
Well, the Russians are conducting exercises with troops and planes right on the border with Ukraine, so they're obviously still players, you know, in this process. Putin doesn't appear likely to back down from everything I've been able to read. Some people have speculated that he may have put Russia in Russia into an untenable economic position, and he might get pressure internally from his Politburo and so forth to make some concessions, but he's not likely to do that, I wouldn't think. which leaves either they push him out and put somebody else in, or the crisis continues to escalate. So it appears at this point that, you know, the crisis will be there for a while. It'll continue to escalate, and you know, we probably will have some more tense moments as this thing progresses. At least it doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. I've seen some reports from the Eurozone suggesting that the first sanctions that were applied to Russia, the ones that people thought would not have much of an effect, did have an effect, particularly in Germany, because Germany is Russia's biggest trading partner. And the sanctions that have been decided upon now will likely have even, you know, more economic impact. I notice, and you never know really how all this is going to develop, but it's a little thing here, a little thing there. For example, Russia is thinking now about preventing overflights of Siberia by international airlines because some sanctions have been put in place to not allow Russian planes to fly somewhere. I forget exactly where it was, but, you know, little things like this can add up over time. So that's probably going to continue to put pressure, you know, on the Eurozone. And this is probably, from a geopolitical concern, the European situation and the Balkan, you know, what's happening in the Balkans or in the Balkans area, Eastern Europe, is probably much more serious than anything else that's happening in the world.
Okay. Well, the Middle East, and obviously
yeah,
it's
the
more
Middle
serious.
East is,
the Middle East, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian
A couple
conflict.
Of us were talking yesterday about the Middle East, and you know, those of us who've been around for a while said, you know, when has the Middle East not been a problem? You
right.
know, it's been a problem even if there's no shooting going on at the moment. This one probably, this flare-up, considering what has gone on in years before, you know, the problems in Syria and Lebanon, you know, with Iran meddling to a greater extent than they have in the past, might make it more serious than anything we've seen in a while, and it's not likely to go away, I guess, anytime soon. Something else I didn't mention, thinking about the Middle East, but really it's more of a European thing. Azerbaijan and Armenia are on the borders of Turkey and Iran. And you don't think about those two countries very much, and I had forgotten, I certainly didn't remember that they fought a small, fairly bloody little war about 20 years ago. And the Russians are in Armenia. They have bases in Armenia, not in Azerbaijan. And that country has oil, and they also ship oil from Azerbaijan through Turkey up into Europe. So to the extent, you know, that begins to deteriorate, then certainly you would have another geopolitical hotspot that might, you know, have some impact on oil flows. It might be a disruptive force. So, you know, it's just something we have to deal with. In 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, a lot of people wrote about the end of history and how peace was upon us and all that sort of thing. And, That rarely happens, and so, you know, here we are again, back to something that was considered, I guess, you know, relatively normal 25, 30 years ago. So, you know, it's there, and it's you know, could be a disruptive influence on investments, but there's just not a great deal you can do about it except understand it and, you know, deal with the issues as they come up.
And briefly, the last issue, and probably didn't get as much headlines, is Argentina defaulted on a bond issue.
Yeah, Argentina has defaulted a number of times. I can't remember how many, and the fact that they did default on this bond issue, I guess, was not really a surprise, although it may have roiled the markets a bit when the news was announced. One of the unusual things about this bond default in Argentina, and I'm not sure whether it's been resolved or not. Maybe one of us on this call might remember this or might know what I'm talking about. But people that bought credit default swaps on the Argentine bonds, thinking that if they did default, they would be paid off, may not be paid off. It depends on how the default is calculated.
Right.
You know,
structured.
It's structured. Is it a real default, a partial default, or what have you? And you know, that may call into question, you know, some of the credit default swap business around the world, because this has happened this has happened before. Something else along those same lines about the Argentine bond default and how, you know, there might be some ripples spreading out from something like that. You might remember we talked about, I think we probably did, the bank in Portugal, the second largest bank in Portugal, Espírito Santo Bank, that failed or was on the verge of failing and has failed since we last spoke about it on this call. They're not hurting the depositors on this. The Portugal took the bank over. The depositors don't have to contribute anything, but the junior bondholders and the stockholders, it looks like, are going to be wiped out. But the interesting thing about this particular bank is that the third largest bank in France today just wrote off 700 million euro of investments they had in that bank. And the unfortunate thing about Europe is, you know, the banks are large, and they have the capacity to take hits like this. But the unfortunate thing about the banks in Europe is they're all interconnected. And so when a bad thing happens to one bank, you may find that there's several other banks that have investments there. So this is not, you know, good for France, obviously. You know, the bank stock actually went up today, that this particular bank, because, you know, their regular business was in pretty good shape. But in any case, you know, that's the kind of the world we live in, with a lot of interconnected debts and, you know, interconnected trade agreements, and it's just going to create some volatility over time.
Okay, thanks, Sean. All right, let's go ahead and shift gears over to stocks, and Luther and I are going to kind of dissect the numbers first, and then we'll come back and get some commentary and color regarding the market. And, you know, it was a pretty difficult month for stocks, and you didn't really see it in the broader averages. The capitalization-weighted S&P 500 was only down 1.4%. You know, obviously not great that we were down, but, you know, it's not a real big number. We did have the worst week in 2 years this past week. The S&P 500 was down 2.7%. But some interesting statistics, and Luther will get into some other numbers. During the month, the average stock in the S&P 1500 was down 4%, and then small-cap stocks were down almost 6% for the month. So when you moved into some of the smaller names, the sell-off was a lot greater, and that's probably why it felt a little bit worse. And obviously, volatility saw a major uptick. Luther, you want to take a little deeper dive into some of those numbers for us? Luther? Are you muted, Luther?
I'll go on to a different conversation.
Well, let's go ahead, John. Just give me your, if you could, your thoughts for the market. You know, as we mentioned, and we've been talking about it for a while, you know, we've been somewhat cautious on stocks. Is this function, is it profit-taking, earnings? Is it all of the geopolitical issues that you discuss that's maybe weighing on stocks? Give us a little color into what you think's going on.
If you look at corporate earnings, trailing corporate earnings, it looks like the second quarter is going to be reasonably decent. You know, quarter by quarter, you know, we look at what's happened and check the estimates, you know, in a general sense. And it looks like year-over-year earnings are going to be at least in the low single digits by the time everything is calculated for the second quarter, probably somewhere between 5 and 8% annualized. To give you an idea of what earnings trends are like historically, if you look at most 10 or 15-year periods throughout history of the U.S. market, average earnings gains are about 6.5%. 6.5% annualized is a pretty good guess to make for most 10-year periods. And that generally makes up the long-term historic return you see people talk about when you add, say, inflation of 2.5% to a 6.5% earnings growth rate. You get about a, you know, 8 or, say, a 9%. You know, guesstimate as to, you know, what, you know, might happen to stock prices over a long period of time. Of course, there's a lot of fluctuation around that average, which, you know, makes for all these cycles we see from time to time. But in any case, if you look at earnings, earnings seem to be tracking along at what we might call year-over-year a long-term average. The problem, as Dave mentioned, from a valuation standpoint, is the market has got relatively expensive compared to, you know, the long-term expectations for the earnings stream. And so when things get a little bit expensive and you get some disruptions internationally and you get some, you know, anything that might disturb the market, I guess, is going to cause, you know, relatively more fluctuations, I guess, rather than less. But the decline that we saw in July was, for the most part, concentrated in small cap stocks. And small caps are more volatile. And I'm not sure that it was an earnings problem, you know, particularly. But earnings have actually improved. Earnings have been pretty decent. What you might be seeing is a situation where the market is becoming more selective.
Right.
If you look inside these large market indices, you'll find that, you know, for example, probably, I think the last time I looked, I'm going to guess and say maybe 15-20% of the small cap index was probably down 20% from their highs. You know, and so you've got a lot of stocks that, you know, the earnings have failed or faltered and the stocks are down, but then you have other stocks that are doing all right. And that kind of seems to be where we are. But, you know, we've been in a very low volatile market environment now for about 18 months to 2 years. And, you know, we all know that at some point that has to end and the market will become more volatile. And so, you know, that's not necessarily something to be worried about, but we just probably get back to a more normal kind of environment. But so far, it looks like things are generally positive from an earnings standpoint. The only thing you wonder is, you know, what's an acceptable price for that? And I guess that's what the market's trying to figure out at the moment.
Okay. And I think Luther is back with us. Luther, are you there? Okay. Apparently, we're having technical difficulties. Jeff, are you there?
I am here. Good morning.
Good morning. So, you know, if you just look at the 10-year Treasury, you know, during the month, yields appeared to be relatively unchanged. But I know there was a lot of gyrations in the bond market over the course of the month. Why don't you give us some color on what happened in July?
Sure. Be glad to. It was a busy month all the way around for the bond market. We had certainly a Federal Reserve meeting, which was an important meeting in that it came on the heels of a lot of better economic news domestically here. So they reflected that. We had the SEC coming out with some reform information on money market funds, which got a lot of people's attention. You had interest rates that were basically a roller coaster ride. As you say, they ended the month largely where they began the month, but it was a bit of a wild ride during that period. We'll start with the Federal Reserve and kind of hit on a couple of the big things that happened. As I mentioned, the Fed met right at the end of July, and because of the better economic news, the statement out of the Fed was modestly more positive. They acknowledged the improvement in the unemployment situation, which is one of their key drivers in terms of their policy, but that they still said there's work to be done there, but it was a noticeable change in that the tone of their assessment of the economy was more positive, and that led people to think that the Fed will move to raise short-term interest rates perhaps sooner than most people had thought. The general consensus was the Fed is probably going to start raising short-term interest rates sometime in the middle part of next year. There's about a 58% probability out there right now that the first move comes, the 25 basis point move comes sometime in the middle of next year. But we're starting to see more and more respected economists say that, well, it may come sooner than that. It may come as soon as March of next year, which is not something that's fully discounted in the marketplace. So that would be a surprise and certainly have an impact on the bond market. One of the reasons for people becoming more certain about the Fed moving to raise short-term interest rates and normalizing their policy stance is that more and more Fed governors, both voting and non-voting members of the FOMC, are starting to come out vocally and say that it's time for us to really get back to a normal policy. This easy money morphine that we've been giving the economy now for several years needs to go. And so they're making it more difficult for the rest of the Fed governors to ignore the fact that we need to get back to a normal policy again. The Fed doesn't meet again until I think it's late September, if I'm not mistaken. And so there won't be much going on here in the near term from a Fed standpoint. They will, it does appear that it's almost certain that they will wrap up their quantitative easing program in October, by the October meeting, so that that at that point they will have phased out of one of the major policy initiatives that they took on for stimulus, and certainly they will have returned that policy back to normal without seeing a dramatic rise in interest rates. So that's good news, although it's anticipated that when they start to raise short-term interest rates, it's likely to have a more profound impact on the bond market. One of the areas where that short-term rate increase might have a big impact is in the money market fund arena. And the Fed and the SEC, I should say, came out recently with some reforms in the wake of the 2008 crisis and the collapse of the Reserve Money Market Fund due to the failure of Lehman going all the way back to 2008. The SEC finally rolled it out, and they said that they were going to institute changes or reforms for institutional money market funds that invest in corporate paper, commercial paper, prime commercial paper, as well as municipal funds. And these institutional money market funds are going to be forced to go to a floating price, a floating net asset value, instead of a constant dollar, which is things that short-term investors like a lot about money market funds, is the fact that you know if you put a dollar in, you'll collect some interest, and you can always get that $1 out. Well, for institutional investors, that's likely to change because of this policy. It's 2 years to implement this, so there's lots of rules that have to be written and transition, but it's a major change in the money market industry. And it's estimated that somewhere between $100 billion and $500 billion will come out of prime money market funds and move into government money market funds. And that's important because the entire T-bill market is only about $1.4 trillion. So that's a third, basically more than a third increase in demand for those T-bills. So it's a significant move in the money market industry, and the one thing certainly that's likely to come out of it is rates that the government borrows on short-term T-bills will likely stay fairly low because of this increased demand. Rates for commercial paper will likely rise because of the decreased demand, which for investors who can tolerate a little bit of fluctuation, a very tiny bit of fluctuation in that net asset value, you might be able to earn a more attractive rate on those commercial paper funds. As I said, that really applies only to the institutional, but we'll see what how the effects ripple through the rest of the money markets as we get closer to that 2 year activation date. And then finally, just a quick rate update. As you mentioned, for the last month or so, short-term rates were essentially flat. I think the government two-year was up about 2 basis points, so not a whole lot of change there. The 10-year, however, was down in yield about 6 basis points. That's what we call a flattening of the yield curve. But more importantly, if we look at what's happened since the beginning of the year, we've seen shorter-term interest rates rise, slightly, and we've seen longer-term interest rates, the 10-year, drop by about 50 basis points so far for this year. So that's, in textbook terms, that's a flattening of the yield curve, which is typically a sign of an economy that's improving. So that dovetails nicely with reality and is exactly what you would expect. So far for this year, the big winners have been corporate bonds, which as of the end of July are up about 3.5%. Mortgages are up about the same, 3.46% exactly, while treasuries have returned so far for this year about half that as much, about 1.3%. And then the big news, I think, and certainly in the fixed income markets, has been the phenomenal performance of the municipal sector. Muni bonds have just done phenomenally so far for this year after really a very difficult last 6 months of 2013. Municipal indices, generally speaking, the broad market indices is up about 6% so far for this year, total return. Again, you can contrast that to corporate bonds at 3.5% and treasuries at 1.3%. So that's just a phenomenal return. Longer-term bond funds are up in the neighborhood of 10%. So for those investors who stuck with their municipal investments last year and focused on the long term, they were handsomely rewarded so far for this year. So it's been a busy month, and it's likely to stay busy with all the improving economy and the Fed action that's taking place, Dave.
Hey, Jeff, and I know you mentioned it a couple times, but I just want to make sure that everybody's really clear. The money market reforms that you talked about, where the dollar per share price will begin to float, that's not scheduled for another 2 years, and it could even be extended, I think, once they get into the details. But nobody really has to worry about taking any action right now. We have a little time to figure out an action plan, if even necessary, correct?
That is correct. And government money market funds are not directly impacted because of this change. They're only indirectly impacted in that there'll probably be more demand for them.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure we're all clear on that. And that concludes our call for today. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And please join us again on Tuesday, September 2nd, for our next call. Thank you so much.